This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
Oh boy, yeah. I've always been a writer, a doodler, pictures, art, drawing, acting, talking, but yeah, I've never put any emphasis on any. I always wrote it off that I'm a Sagittarian, so that's why I'm interested in a lot of things. I never, concentrated on one thing. I said, this is what I do. I write for a while. I act for a while. I make movies for a while. Even when I was a little kid, that's what I did. Spend my downtime from school. That's what I did.
Yeah, so like all sorts of different interests, just tons of them, soaking them all
up.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Wow. How did you first get into creative stuff? You said when you were a little kid, were you making, doing performances with your brothers and sisters? Do you have siblings?
I have a sister that she was into other things. She was just into art I don't know. My family life was not of the best quality, let's put it that way.
Okay.
So my parents really didn't want any artists around.
Sure.
They're really, kind of against curiosity and any learning. I guess that's what they were against, learning. I was always a rival of my father. We just never got along because I don't know why. I went to a therapist for a while years and years ago to discuss this, and it turns out that I was like a threat to him. I don't know why, but we didn't get into that, into him. I was talking about me, but artistic stuff was not liked around the house. There was no books in the house. So basically my introduction to art was a fight. I had to go elsewhere, out of the house, to act or to hang out with other kids who wrote or stuff like that. My house was a barren desert of intellectual curiosity.
Huh. So you had a
friend
then?
Yeah, it was kind of hard.
Yeah, I mean, that's not great to have no creativity in your childhood, for sure.
It was really, really, they wanted a doctor or a lawyer, somebody who would make a lot of money or take care of them in their old age. That was the kind of thrust that I was kind of getting, signals that I was getting.
Yeah.
So I had to actually leave the house to follow my bliss, as they say. I didn't start doing anything artistic that I could use until I actually graduated Syracuse University. And then I went to that's where my theatrical and artistic growth started. I went to Syracuse University, and one of my best friends there, I didn't have too many, but one of them was Carl Gottlieb, who wrote Jaws, the big movie. Mm-hmm. So he was a writer. We just hung out together. And that's how I kind of drifted to the art the drama school. I was in industrial design because my parents, I mean, that was as close as I could get to having my parents give me the nod of art, industrial design. So it was like industry, but it was design, so they okayed it. And so when I went to college, I was attracted to the drama department, and I just hung around there. Much to the consternation of all my other teachers in industrial design, kept on saying, no, look, you got to pick one. You can't be an actor and an industrial designer. You can't do that. So I was kind of thrown out of school twice because of that, arguing with the teachers about what I wanted to do and what they wanted me to do and why wasn't I getting... It's been a struggle until I finally graduated, and then me and Carl went to Greenwich Village. He wanted to be a writer. That's all he ever wanted to be. So I just said, okay, I'll just go along with him because I don't know what the heck I'm going to do. I certainly don't want to be an industrial designer, although I was good at it. So we went to Greenwich Village, and he started to review movies for these small papers in New York, obscure little papers. But he was reviewing movies, and that's what he wanted to do, right? And I just hung around, washing duckboards at bars after closing time. There was nothing I wanted to do, period. I'll leave it right there. There's nothing I wanted to do. Really, until I started to hang around in the coffee houses late at night, either waiting to go to work or to clean up the bars at night, or this bar at night. I started going to Monday night, open mic nights, because we lived in the village and that's what was going on, these coffee houses. So I'd say, wait a minute, I was always funny in high school. I won funniest in high school, my senior and junior year in the yearbook. So I thought, yeah, I can do that. I would be watching these guys on stage and these women on stage, not many women back then, and I thought, yeah, that's what I'd like to do. I couldn't write. I mean, I didn't know how to write a joke. I mean, I could write, but I didn't know how to write a comedy stand-up routine. I couldn't get that. So I just would get up on a stage and I would just talk about my day. And it didn't go over very well, but it's the interesting thing to me was why I kept doing it. I mean, I wasn't very good, but every Monday night, I'd go to open mic nights, whenever they were, Tuesday, Monday, whenever. And I started getting good for some strange reason. I guess you just do it. And I had a proclivity, I guess, for humor. I mean, I was funny in high school, although I didn't write it down. I was just like a smart aleck. And I guess it worked on stage, being a smart aleck. So finally, I was opening for Woody Allen. Woody's manager, he was a big-time manager, came into one of the coffee houses one night. I come off the stage, and he said, hey, you got a manager? I don't know. So you like one? I said, yeah. He goes, okay, you got one. Me and you. Okay. And then he said, he let me do that for another couple of months. He would come in, check it, and then he'd say, okay, Rick and Woody need somebody to open for him. And I would be watching Woody, because he was playing in nightclubs in the village, and when the manager said, I'm Woody Allen's manager, I started to go to Woody's shows just to see what a professional, he wasn't famous yet, but he was a professional, and and he was okay. I mean, I didn't get his humor either. I was pretty naive, and I probably still am, but back then I didn't get the whole hippie thing or the drug thing, but I talked about it, and all my friends were hippies. So on the stage, I would be talking about marijuana and drugs and cursing and saying, fucking all that stuff. So I kept on saying to my manager, hey, Woody got on TV. Why don't you put me on TV? He said, Larry, you can't say that stuff on TV. This is back in the 60s, You can't say that stuff on television. You got to get TV stuff, which I couldn't. since I wasn't writing anything, I would just get up on the stage and, you know, I was getting pretty clever at telling my day in a very funny way. So I never wrote it down, so I didn't know what it meant. Well, I knew what it meant, but I mean, I told him I couldn't write TV material. I don't write stuff. I just get up and start talking, and it turns out to be funny. So he didn't know what to do with me, and then finally I started to open for, besides Woody, because I was opening for Woody, word got around, and so I was opening for the Kingston Trio and Miles Davis. And, but Miles Davis was cool because he wanted me to tour with him in Europe, but I didn't know that that would be cool. I just said, I want to leave the United States. I want to be famous here. So I started to open for the Kingston Trio, and they're like TV. In other words, their audience really didn't like me, although the Kingston Trio did. I knew one of them, Stuart, but I forgot his first name. But, he used to come to see my shows in the village every once in a while. But I was booed off the stage, and I didn't understand why, but finally they started to attack me like Lenny Bruce. In other words, cops started pulling me off the stage, and then a guy came at me with a beer bottle upside down in his hand, and he just came at me and said, get the fuck off the stage, man. Bring out the Kingston Trio. We don't want to hear this crap. So I said, okay, fine. I'm not going to fight with him. He was pretty big, and he had a beer bottle in his hand. So I got off the stage and sat at the bar, and just pretended I was another customer.
Yeah.
And so he sat down, the Kingston Trio came out. Well, no, the Kingston Trio didn't come out. The bartender came over to me and said, what are you doing here? And I said, did you see that guy on the, it was a nightclub, and it was a dance floor. I said, didn't you see that guy come across the dance floor, man, with a bottle on? He's going to hit me, man. He said, yeah. He said, where's the bouncer? Where's the bouncer? He said, I'm the bouncer. I said, well, you didn't, he said, just get back on the stage. You have 10 more minutes before the Kingston Trio come out. I said, I'm not going out there until you tell that guy to either get out or protect me. And he said, no, you just get out on the stage and finish your 10 minutes or you don't get paid. So I said, I'm not getting paid. He said, well, then get out. So I did. I walked out and I called my manager and I said, hey, man, I can't do this anymore. So he said, well, what do you mean you can't do that? I said, no, this guy came at me. Cops are taking me off the stage. I'm not Lenny Bruce. I don't do drugs. It's just... So he said, join Second City. They do the same stuff that Lenny does, only they own the theater and nobody can come at you. They'll throw that guy out. So that's what I did. I auditioned. Actually, I auditioned with Robin Williams, which he wasn't Robin Williams at the time, but I recognized his, bib overalls. He used to work in bib overalls, and I just recognized him. He'd been around for a while. So we both got in. He went to one company. I went to another.
Is this Second City, New York?
Second City in New York, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
But they shipped me to St. Louis. They had a company in New York. They had a company in Chicago. And they were starting to open companies all over the place. And so one of the places was the Crystal Palace in St. Louis. So we went down there. They formed a company with me and, five other people. And they sent us down. I thought I would be in New York. That's where I saw the show and auditioned in New York. And they sent me to St. Louis, us. And we were there we were booked there for a month. And we were held over for 9 months. So we were pretty cool.
Wow.
But we were in St. Louis. So finally, Paul Sills, the director of Second City, wanted to see what was going on. I mean, he just sent us down there. Second City just sent us down to Crystal Palace and left us there. We never heard from them. I guess we were doing okay, and they were getting their cut from the Crystal Palace, So they just didn't bother with us. And then finally, Falsos came down and watched the show, and he picked me and Jack Burns. Jack Burns, who invented, wrote after he left Second City, that's what he did. So me and Jack went up to Chicago. Now we were in the Chicago show, so this to us was big time. And yes, there I
big time now.
Learned really how to improvise, and because that was the home base. That was Paul Sills. That was Viola Spolin. That was Del Close. That was Severin Darden. I mean, these were huge icons back then, still to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, Del Close and Severin Darden. They were great, you know. They were just amazing, these improvisers, people who worked off the top of their head. And also, I was a big fan of Mike Nichols and Elaine May, who came out of Second City. So I was just steeped in the best. I mean, that was, you know, it was heaven for me. So
it's a heyday of improv, for sure.
That's where I learned. Excuse me?
I said the heyday of improv, for sure. Where,
Yeah, and that's where I learned how to teach. And because I studied with Viola Spolin, who, like, she's like the Lee Strasberg of improv. I mean, so I studied with her. And Del, as a matter of fact, me and Del were in her class. So I was with Del, who turned out to be a great innovator of improvisation later on when he became a teacher and had his own company, well, who directed at Second City. And I was working under Paul Sills, who was the son of Viola Spolin. So, yeah, I'm very proud of that. I'm very, you know, and just lucky that I just got there when all these people were working. So I used to watch them on the stage or stand out in the back. Well, then I finally got in the show company, and so I was working with them. And Dick Shaw, I mean, another incredible improviser. I mean, it was just amazing. It just blows my mind. It just talking about it just blows my mind.
Yeah, what was the show situation up there? How many years did you perform? Were you performing every day or just occasionally?
Well, first of all, we had to go to class. You know, first when I auditioned in New York and they sent us down to St. Louis, so we were there for 9 months with a director. He wasn't famous, or he was really a movie director, but he was a great director for our show, and we were held over for 8 months or whatever.
Yeah.
So I did know how to improvise because I learned it just by being on stage every night at the Crystal Palace for 9 months, 8 months, 9 months. So when I finally got there, and Paul Sills came down and he saw me and Jack were really good. Jack was really more, he worked off the top of his head as jokes. Now, that was looked down on. There were certain things, I mean, rules that, you know, everybody believed that we were just making it up, you know. Because it was so seamless, the rules of improv, that you couldn't tell. I mean, if you were in the audience, you know, just watching the show, and maybe, a doctor waiting for a bus with a nurse or a pilot or whatever. And then we'd just go and we'd improvise these great shows. I mean, we were really good. So it looks like, wow, they're just making that up. But the rules, there really are rules of improvisation. Yeah, and you know the book Viola Spolin's, Viola Spolin's book. I forgot the name of it now. But
yeah, yeah.
She wrote the rules down. You know, and so I was in her class while she was writing that. I was in her class when Paul Sills brought us up from St. Louis. I immediately went into her class and didn't go on the main stage. We were considered neophytes, me and Jack. And even though we had been working for 9 months and been held over and were a hit down there, we were immediately up there and we went to Chicago and we were in Viola Spolin's class and we had to be there. So I was in the class, and everybody had to take the class, even the main stage people, Del Close, who was working on main stage, even he had to be in the class. So I was in an advanced class, but still I wasn't working, just in the class. And me and Del always would talk about downplay or this Viola and the way she was teaching. We didn't like her. I didn't like her. Del didn't like her because she was a very strict teacher for improv. I don't know how to do that. But she would side coach all the time, which we considered an interruption. You know, like, no, work with your where, or, you know, say, you've lost the object, you know, remember your object work, you know, the mind thing. She would be always, and we would hate that. Shut up, Viola. Little didn't know. But she was incredible. I mean, later on, you go, wow, am I glad I studied with her. So, and she was writing the book at the time, because after class, sometimes classes were at night, after the show or maybe during the show, downstairs in another part of the theater. So after the show, she would take us, and he'd say, you know, anybody want to go for coffee? So we would go to a coffee house down the block from where the theater was. This is in North Town, I guess, or Old Town, somewhere. And she would read us the proofs for her book that she was writing, because I guess Improv to the Theater. Is that the name of it? Do you remember the name of her book? I don't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But she would read these things to us, and I remember thinking, bullshit. Now, but she was reading to us from the proof for the book that was going to come out, I guess, in a couple of months, the very things that she was teaching us in class. And yeah, we were fighting, you know, like side coaching and the where and the whatever and the yes and. But we would go along with it because it worked. And when we had to do our scenes, we did good scenes because we followed her rules. But when she was reading it, I was just thinking, and so was Dal, because we went because we thought, well, it's good vibes for the teachers, you know, she'll like this if we go to these coffee things. But we thought what she's reading is bull. Yet we were doing the stuff that she was reading, and I don't know how I didn't make the connection of how I could not like what was being read, but, you know, thought, well, okay, except for the side function, she's pretty good. Anyway, it worked, and finally I got in the main company, and so I was working with all these great people. And then finally we got fired. I mean, we got let go. Fired, I guess. Okay. And the reason was very simple, and I probably, maybe you know this, if you want to show, but there was 9 people. We were the last hired. I was the last hired with Jack. Last hired, first fired. We had 9 people on the stage. And I was with, you know, Barbara Harris. She was incredible. As far as women goes, I've never been on a stage with anybody who could be as funny and as real as that woman was. I mean, just amazing. You know, it was like she wasn't being funny. She was just being real, and she would bring down the house. I mean, it would be, I guess, kind of like Elaine May and Mike Nichols. She was of that level of just improv. So we were let go because there was 9 people on the stage. It works with 5 people. It really does. In those days, it was 4 guys and a girl. That was the rule. I don't know where that came from or how it got that way and why it works that way. I don't know if it, I've never been in a show where there was 2 guys and 3 girls or 1 guy and 4 girls. There was always 4 guys and 1 girl. I have no idea why that was, except machoism. Machoism in the theater. I don't know. It never reared its head that way. But I always wondered about that. I really did. Even when we went to, so I hung around with Jack. He went on to Hollywood and wrote Hee Haw from there. And I
did you teach
Chicago
in
for a little while.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you teach something different? You mentioned that, you know, you guys had a hard time with the style, you know, that Viola was doing, but did you
right.
end up going off to the side with Dell and teaching something different? You mentioned teaching, and I just wondered, did you teach at Second City,
that was
or did you teach
was,
like later?
That was years later. That was, I was just an actor who just wanted to improv for the rest of my life in Second City. I mean,
oh, right.
I still do. I loved it. I can't do it anymore, by the way. You have to, because I haven't improvised in years.
Yeah.
That's a muscle, man. You got to do that. You got to do that, or it just goes away. So we were let go. Jack and I were let go, and I hung around Second City and slept on one of the actors' couches because I didn't have any money once I was fired from Second City. So I stayed there for about a month. I would come down and hang out, you know, at night because I had no place else to go. I was trying to figure out, should I go back to New York? Should I go to the West Coast, to Hollywood, try to be an actor? So I was just on this guy's couch. And so after the show, or during the show, they had a bar downstairs in the theater, the Second City in Chicago. They had a bar downstairs. And so I would hang out with the people, with the actors who either were in the class or who were in the show but weren't on for a while. So they would go down and just hang in the bar until they get a cue from a microphone. Hey, you know, Larry, come upstairs. You're in the next scene. So I would be, and in walks somebody, comes in and says, is there a Larry Hank in here? So I go, yeah, it's me. What? He says, there's a car outside. There's some people who want to talk to you. So I go outside, and it was the middle of the winter. I think it was like a very slight snow outside. I remember it was cold. It was freezing outside. And I just, because I just ran out, and put on a coat, I just ran outside. And there was all these people who turned out to be the committee later on in San Francisco. But now they were in this car in second outside. And Alan Meyerson, the director, who was the director who auditioned me in New York to get the job to go to St. Louis. So Alan Myers is in this car in Chicago, and four strange people I'd never seen before. And the top of the car, it was like a station wagon, and the top of the car was full of luggage, just tied down, suitcases and bags and stuff. And the car was crowded. There was like four, five people. There was two kids, I think, in the car. And it was just jammed. And Alan said, hey, we're going. I heard you were fired. They were just left from New York. He was running the company in New York all the time, even when I was at St. Louis. They had quit. He had quit and taken four of his best students with him and their families, their wife and kids. And they were going to San Francisco to open up their own theater called The Committee, and they wanted me in because he remembered me from one of the classes he taught in New York. And he said, you know, he thought I was pretty good. So he said, hey, you know, you need another person. Let's go. And I said, no, I'm not sitting in that car. I don't know where you're going. Yeah, San Francisco. Yeah, right, sure. No, I'm not going until you send me a ticket. I'm not getting in this car. There's too many people. And there really was. I mean, it was packed. They were even glad I was getting it. So they did. They sent me a ticket. I waited. They drove off into the night. You know, I thought, well, I'll never see that of them again. But I did give him my address in New York. And sure enough, so I went back to New York. I guess I took a bus right through. God knows where I got the money from. Anyway, back in New York, I got a ticket. They actually sent me a plane ticket. So I wasn't doing anything. I was, you know, back to doing stand-up in coffee houses and stuff. My manager just thought I was set in improvising. He had told me, you know, during the Second City. So he couldn't book me anymore. because I lost all the momentum I had. And so I went to Chicago. I went to second, getting it all mixed up now. I went to San Francisco with the committee. I flew there. They were building a theater, so we didn't even know if this was going to be a success. They had raised enough money to renovate a Chinese supermarket or a bocce ball court. That's what it was.
Yeah,
they renovated a Chinese bocce ball court in San Francisco, in North Beach, and were building a theater. So we didn't even know if we had jobs, really. And we were all living together in one apartment, a big railroad flat, all of us, families, five acts, six actors, two kids, wives, and the director and his wife. And we opened and we struggled a little in the beginning. We only, if the rule was, this is how we struggled. If there was more people in the company than there was in the audience, we didn't have to do a show. So we did that a lot.
Yeah, I hear
so
that.
So then we had those rules. And then finally it started to build, and we started to get great reviews. And then one day, I'll never forget this, man. It was one of the highlights of my life. Is we were waiting backstage to open. It was like a Saturday night or something. And I was with Hamilton Camp. I remember that. He was my best friend in the company. And he was a folk singer, I think, but, before he got into the community. I said, Hamilton, come outside. You got to see this. He says, what? I said, just come outside. So I said, okay. We had about 15, 20 minutes before the show was on. So we walked out into the Columbus Boulevard Avenue, where our theater was. And we walked outside, went across the street, and there was a line for the committee around the block. It was amazing. It was the first time that I'd ever seen anything like that. And from then on, we were just a smash hit. But it went around the block, not just around the corner, around the block. We walked it. One corner. And it just almost came around the fourth corner. It was amazing.
Awesome.
And from then on, we were just a hit of San Francisco. And I thought, well, I'll be here for the rest of my life. This is cool. And we were the hit of San Francisco and everything like that. And we were there for a long time, years. And then everybody, because it was only, I think, 15 or 20 bucks round trip to fly up from Hollywood to San Francisco, from L.A. to San Francisco. So a lot of stars and important people, they would hear about this amazing show, like Second City, but up in San Francisco, called The Committee. And they would fly up, and they would see the show and then start hiring us, to come down and do sitcoms down there. But they didn't like improv. They just wanted, because we're talented and funny. So we would fly down every once in a while, and then back. And it was only 20 bucks, and that was really, really cool. You fly down for 3 days, you come back. Since it was an improv show, as you probably know, anybody could fill in for anybody else, so nobody was ever missing. My fear was that I could be replaced. Because anybody could be replaced. We were all being replaced by when we would go down for 3 days to do one day of shooting. Come back and somebody would do your part or improvise a different ending to it or whatever. So I was in constant fear of being replaced. No confidence in myself, really. But I never was. Every time I come back, I get back in the show and replace somebody else who went down there. But I never got over that. And finally, the entire company had been replaced by permanently moving to Hollywood and making some good bucks. I just wanted to stay in San Francisco. And then finally, I started directing. That's what I did, because I was now the senior member of the committee. So I was directing shows, and that was boring. And I remember doing an interview. And they said, what's the difference between, you used to be a big star, you were with the rest of the company, you were big stars here. well, what's the difference? Now you're directing, you're not on stage. Now you're directing your own company. What, you know, how does that feel? And I remember, and he quoted it. I said, it's very frustrating. He said, why? I said, because I just feel like there's five people between me and the audience. Because I know where the scene should go. You know, I'm watching it, I'm directing it. And you can't do that. That's one of the rules. All right, talk about teaching. Here's what I learned. And actually, Alan Meyerson told me this, because when he left, I said, you know, can you give me any hints about directing, you know, improv? And he said, okay, I'll give you just one rule. You can't take any, I mean, you're going to be watching these scenes, you're going to be directing them, you're going to be adjusting them. You can see where the scene should go because you're standing outside, you're watching them every night. You can see, well, it should go here. You can even formulate how it should end, the whole thing. You can't tell them that. You can't interfere with that. But he said, here's the rule. The rule is that all improv scenes, there's only a finite number of ways after a certain, I mean, if you can see that the scene is a success, so let's do it again tomorrow night, you know, try it another way. But there's somewhere there's a seed of an idea there, of a good scene there. Once you understand that, the rule applies, there's only a finite amount of ways this scene can go where it can be a success. You don't know the amount, but all you have to know is there's a finite way. There's only a certain amount of ways. So, under that guise, what you do is you say, do it again. And you just tell them to keep doing it again or make an adjustment. You know, instead of, you know, talking about that, talk about this. Just slightly different. But eventually, because there's a finite number of ways, they will come upon it. It may take you a week. It may take you 2 months. I mean, sometimes we would work on a really great scene for about 3 or 4 months before we'd ever put it in the show. Just each night we would improvise it, or we would work on it in rehearsal. Never write anything down, just, you know, just do it again, or do it this way. And then finally they would hit it. They would go, you would see it, and they would go, oh man, one more. Boom, they got it, okay. And then they would say, okay, let's just, that's it. We got it, we're putting it in the show. You see, you can never take, you can never own it. You can never say, yeah, I knew it was going to go that way, you know, 2 months ago. You can't take that away from him. So he says, but, how do you get off? You know, what's in it for you then as the director? He said, well, you knew, that's all. That's your reward. You knew it was going to work. And you knew probably, and that was a great thing for him to tell me, even about life. It was just great, but it worked. And I directed there for about 2 shows. I opened 2 shows over, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. And then I finally went down to Hollywood because there was money down there.
Succumbed to the siren song.
Yeah, but also I wasn't working. I mean, sure. I'm a performer, you know, and yeah. It just I wasn't getting up. I wasn't getting my reward. I wasn't making it funny, you know, the first night, not after 6 months of working through them. I have 5 people in between me and the audience. I'll never forget that interview. Because I heard myself say it, and it kind of woke me up, you know.
So for you, like, the creative process of performing is the most fulfilling. Like, when you get to create and present something to an audience, that's what really you love the most.
The creative process is my reward. It doesn't matter about acting or making a painting or, making a film. I make films, you know, little comedy films. Making it, the making of it, the process. I'm all about process. And I think that's the key to everything. Even if you want to be a doctor, the process, doing it. I think, there's a bunch of cliches if you look through any book, you know, doing it is where it's at. That's it, man. That's all you do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you get better. And concentration, focus. In other words, desire. Thank you, Mr. Dillon. Desire and process. You got to want to do it. Right? You can't force yourself to do it. And if you don't want to do it, it's not going to go in. That's just I'm speaking from personal. If I don't want to do something, you can teach me until the apocalypse. And I ain't going to learn it. I mean, even if I tell you I want to, or if it's in my best interest that I learn this. No, I mean, it's like my parents, you know?
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to be a doctor. And so the process being the reward, it's kind of a double-edged sword, kind of a curse and a great thing. Because money is not, you can't bribe me. And unless it's a lot of money, then sure. But that's not where I'm at. You know? I like money.
Sure.
It frees you up to do a lot of things you do like. But that's not the key. I was playing, focus. I mean, in other words, the desire helps you focus, and focus is what needed to conquer or absorb the process. That seems to be it. And if you like what you're doing, then you're home free. That's where you got to be. You got to like what you're doing. And if you like what you're doing, the rest is just, hey, well, okay.
Yeah.
I'll get through this part because I love the other stuff about it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, acting, the downside of acting is memorizing the line.
Yeah.
Who wants to memorize the line? Oh, man. Forget it.
Yeah.
You know, and they always reward me. Like, I did a movie for, I was doing a Breaking Bad, you know, I was in that. And so I auditioned for it. The great thing about auditioning, because first of all, I love the show, you know, so I'd be watching it. So I was a fan. So
that's awesome.
Get an audition for something you love, for a program that you love, ooh, I'm going to audition for Breaking Bad. That was like such a cool thing for me personally. Just wow. It wasn't even that. I didn't care if I got it or not. The very fact that I was going to audition for Breaking Bad was such a high. So I went in, and the other high was, because I'm by the way, I'm dyslexic, so my fear and hate of learning lines is endemic to me. I mean, my dyslexia has to do with memorization.
Sure.
It's not like memorization. It scrambles stuff.
Yeah.
Linear learning. I'm an eidetic learner. I actually have to do it to learn it. You can't tell me how to do it. I mean, you know, you can tell me, you know, push this button. Okay. You can tell me push that button and then that button. Okay. You can tell me to push that button and that button and that button. Okay. And then, no.
Yeah.
Fourth one. What comes after three? Four.
Believe me, I have so many notebooks filled with instructions for myself.
There you go.
That's how I do everything.
And I wasn't into everything because I had a great memory.
Yeah.
But not so linear. In other words, I can memorize weird shit, but not linear. Okay, anyway, I got over that because I loved being in front of the camera and performing it, doing it, being there. Being there now, being here now, you know, which is all acting is. Really. And so I pressed through that. So I auditioned, and the whole point about that is I only had five lines. So not only was I auditioning for my favorite show of all time, but I only had to memorize five lines. So, you know, four lines, five lines. Okay, I can do it. It was easy. I didn't have to sweat for three nights memorizing. So I auditioned. There was nobody even there. It was just I went in, she said, you just want to do it? It was just one woman with a camera and an empty room. That was the audition.
That's every audition
and
I've
she
ever
said,
done.
You want to do, excuse me, what?
I said, that's every audition I've ever done. I understand.
Oh, well, sometimes there's a whole phalanx of people in the room.
Sure, that, I heard about those.
Depends on how. Yeah. So I went in and she said, well, you want to talk about it? You want to do it? So I was kind of disgusted at that point because I thought, this is a throwaway audition. In other words, there wasn't enough people in the room. I thought it wasn't important enough that they only gave, one woman who was obviously an assistant. And in an empty room. I mean, there was only a chair and a tripod with a camera, a woman, and me. And that was it. It was an empty little room. Mm. So I kind of was, they don't really care about this. This is a joke or a put on. So I just said, no, I don't want to talk about it. She said, all right, you just want to do it? I go, yeah. So then she starts to read with me. Now, I don't know, when you audition, you generally have somebody read with you, not the person who's working the camera. Because she was working the camera, looking at the screen, reading her lines, but not paying any attention to me, which in my naivete didn't tell me, look, that's that important about her. They're going to be looking at what's in the camera, whoever's going to hire me. Hmm. They don't even know who's reading with me. So you got to concentrate on just doing your part. It doesn't matter. She's not looking at you. She's reading lines. Mm-hmm. That bothers. Anyway, I just did it. And then she says, okay, thank you very much. I did my 5 lines. She says, okay, thank you very much. And I go, that's it? And she says, no, I don't know. You want to do it again? And I go, do I have to? And she says, no. I said, do you want me to do it again? And she says, not really. And I go, okay, I'm out of here. She says, okay, fine. And I thought, well, there you go. There's my favorite show. Well, I did an audition. They'll see my face in it. And then the next day I got the call. Yeah, you're hired. So that was cool. Here's the twist. The twist is I get in my costume and I'm so stoked. It's amazing. I got my line. It's only 5. It's my favorite show. I like the part. And I walk into the... my dressing room, and on the table, on your dressing room table, generally your lines. They give you your lines in case you want to read them over before you go out. So there's my little book, my little line. And I go on the first page of my lines, there's a speech as long as the page. There's a page long monologue on top of my 5 lines. And I say to the AD who led me in, I say, well, what's this? She says, Vince liked you so much he wrote you a monologue. Huh? I go, no, you can understand. No, I can't do this. Man, I start to freak, man. I just start to lose it. And it is an AD, he's a kid, so he started to go, hey, man, I don't know anything about this. I got to get back to the set. He's going to get out of there. He's like, oh, man, another actor's going to freak out on him. He just walked out, something. I said, wait a minute. He goes, what? I said, how long do I have before I got to shoot this? Is 2 hours. I can't do it. I don't know about that, man. And he just walked out. So then I tried to memorize it, but obviously I couldn't. So that was, that was the downside of being an actor and process. I memorized it as best I could, which I couldn't really. I just wanted to tell you about fear and how dyslexia interrupts my great bliss of, performing in front of the camera. The end of that scene, the end of that story is that when I got onto the set, I figured, well, I don't really know it, but if they break it up, because it's a long monologue, if they break it up, I can maybe manage it in sections, And so I went to the director and I said, hey, we're going to shoot this in sections, right? And he goes, no, we're going to shoot a walk and talk. You'll get down there at the end of the, it was at the, in a junkyard. He says, you get down there and walk towards the camera and we'll just do the whole thing in one take. And I go, oh, man. Okay, fine. He says, something wrong? No, because I just figured out I'm going to get fired. I mean, there's just no way I can do it. I had given up. So I go down there, and he says, okay, you're ready? And I go, yeah, I'm ready. And he says, okay, you know, action, roll it, Larry, go. So I start walking, and I'm just talking. I'm just trying to remember pieces of it, whatever. And it's a law thing. It's not law. It's not, you know, why this cop can't look in the Winnebago legally under the law because he doesn't have a search warrant and I'm the owner of the property. Mm-hmm. But it's all legalese. And I'm just talking and talking. And I figure, okay, at the end of this, when I get to the finish line, I'm going to be fired. And I get to the end, and the director just goes, okay, let's do that again, Larry. I go, what? Did I just memorize that? He didn't say anything. He just says, you know, let's do it again. I go, okay. Fine, so I'm not mentioning it. I go back all the way back. And I thought, well, he probably got this. I don't have to worry about the second take. I'll just relax and do it again, you know. So I relax, and so I go back to the spot. And now I see the script girl.
Yeah.
The one who, you know. I see the script girl coming to me with pencil poised. That's a bad sign. Because when she's coming to you, she's going to tell you the word that you missed or the line that you missed. That's why she's coming over to you. I know that. So she comes up to me and she says, I go, okay, what did I miss? And she says, and she shows me the script. Practically every other word is circled. And she said, you got to say it the way it's written. And I go, look, let me talk to Vince. You know, right away, I'm getting defensive. I want to talk to Vince. Vince is not here. I said, okay, then let me talk. Did Vince write this? And she said, no, Vince didn't. She just wanted this written for you. I go, okay, let me talk to the writer. She says, the writer is the director, and he wants you to read it as written. I go, oh, okay. All right. So now, again, I'm being fired. So I go back, and he says, is there something wrong, Larry? He shouts at the end of his walk. I go, no, it's okay, fine. He says, okay, let's roll it. So I just did it again, the exact same thing. Blah, 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 boom. And then he says, okay, thank you very much, Larry. Moving on. And I go, what the hell just happened, man? I could not figure it out. And then I was wrapped. And I put the other part of my scene I had already shot. That was the five lines.
Yeah.
That I had already done. So I was just wrapped, and they took me back, and I went home. And So when I watched the show, my friends, the name of my friend's company is Movies is Magic. That's the name of his production company. And this is why he named it that. When I watched the show, because I wanted to see what the heck, what they did was, and he knew all along, this director, this writer-director, I guess he's really brilliant. What they did was, okay, here's the setup. Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul are in the Winnebago hiding. The guy I'm talking to is a cop who wants to look in the Winnebago. And I don't want them to because they paid me to keep that cop away from the Winnebago. So I got to talk him out of it legally that you can't be here unless you have a search warrant. It's a long speech. Here's how they filmed it. My first two lines are on me walking. Then they cut inside to Brian and Aaron whispering to themselves. But you hear my voice over there whispering. And then you cut to the cop listening to me back inside, one line to me, and the director kept on doing it. So basically what he did was he knew I couldn't memorize it, like wasn't going to be able to memorize it. So he had me do it twice, and he edited together the legalese that he needed to keep the cop out of the Winnebago. And then he just stayed on Aaron and Brian and the cop and cut to me every time I got a good line that, you know, fit what he needed. And movies is magic. You look at it, and I went to my friends the next day because I was blown away by the genius of movies is magic. And I said to my friends, hey, did you watch me last night? So I asked about three different friends at three different times during the day. I said, did you see, you know, me last night? Or, yeah, man, you were so cool, man. That was really great. I said, what did you see? What do you mean? What did you see when you watched my scene there, you know, with the Winnebago? Well, you were walking and you were talking this legalese crap, you know, and they were in the Winnebago and you were talking to the cop. Yeah, but was it me talking? Yeah, you were walking, you were talking this legalese. Like, no, man. What do you mean? Watch it again. I'm on screen maybe for 10 seconds or less. It's all on them and the cop. They just cut to me for a line. There's no shit. No. Yeah, and all three of them, and if you ask anybody who watches that scene, they'll say, yeah, you just walked and talked, and you were talking, and they were hiding. The way it was edited, if you are convinced it's me all the time. No, it isn't, because I'm on screen for 10 seconds. So, I mean, that's just brilliant. I mean, that just blew my mind about, oh, editing, man. Film is editing. You know, you can have a
so nice for there to be an editor.
Well, but a lot of actors, a lot of the stars, because I've worked with them, I'm always asking questions. You know, they say, yeah, well, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing. They protect you if your part is important enough. You know, you're saying a plot line or your characters were important. They'll protect you in the editing room. You know, a lot of, you know, big stars have said to me, you know, I've never been bad after they edit me. You know, so I yeah, right. I mean, the audience doesn't know what they threw away, which is, you know, when you're an actor, you don't think that way.
Yeah.
You know, they'll see every bad time I screwed up. No, they threw that away. The audience has no idea how bad you actually were. You know, it doesn't occur. So that was another great, you know, I guess, epiphany of how to do it.
So we've talked we were talking a lot about your improv background, and we've sort of got to the point where you're headed to Hollywood, but that's a big old chunk. So I guess I just have a couple of questions about it. With reference to something that you mentioned creative process and how important it is for you. When you moved into film and television and that kind of like industry situation, I imagine it's a lot different than doing the live theater shows that you had been doing for years and years before that. How were you able to like get back into a comfortable creative process while also dealing with the, you know, sort of ups and downs of Hollywood as an industry and you just trying to get jobs?
With difficulty is the short answer. I couldn't get used to the comparatively over-the-top acting on stage compared to the movies, which is totally real, man.
Yeah.
You know, be here now. So it was very difficult because, again, it was a learning curve that I just wasn't into. Although I did want to be in movies because there was what the money was. And when I did do it well, like the sitcoms, see, I cut my acting teeth on sitcoms where you can be broad.
Yeah.
They're not over the top, but broad. Especially Laverne and Shirley. And so in the beginning, I was in the broad comedies. And then as the comedies started to get realer in the acting department and the writing department over 3 or 4 years, because you don't act that many. In over 3 or 4 years, you may have 5 or 10 jobs. Or,
yeah.
You know, 8 or. I don't, in other words, it was a slow process because the work comes in slow where you can practice what you think you've learned. So it took me years. And then my agents wanted me to start getting serious. They were starting to send me up for serious roles. And that was a big failure, really, in the beginning. I mean, I just couldn't make the leap between broad and real to do the real acting. So I would get like very small parts, you know, maybe with a plot line where I would get a close up. So it was an important part, but it was short where I could kind of relax and be real for a very short time to get used to it. So in that way, it was a kind learning process. And also, I didn't get the big, real, serious roles because my audition wasn't real and serious. It was kind of broad, too broad for what they were looking for. Until I finally got it. You know, I auditioned enough serious roles and failed to start to understand. Just like stand-up comedy, you know, you do it, and you're bad and bad, and somehow I learn. I'm a learner. A slow learner, okay, but a learner nonetheless. I do learn, and you got to know that about yourself. You know, if I want to do something, I'll hang in there, you know, and my desire to be a serious actor start to click in. And then finally, you know, I mean, and the pièce de résistance of all that was a couple of months ago, you know, when I did Barry and I did a really serious role with a backstory. That was the first time I ever created a backstory for a serious role. I never, because improv, you know, the backstories, you know, doctor, you got it, boom, you know, whatever, pilot, boom, you got it, you know, just instant. So, and I would always do that, even, I never get a backstory, maybe a little, but for Barry, and so that was like very, when Bill Hader is a great director, by the way, as all the great directors are, and the reason is that they know what they're doing, and they know how to get the best out of you. That's, you know, they don't tell you what to do. They get the best out of you. You become the best you. So with Barry and Bill Hader, he never said one thing to me the entire time. I was sweating that. Because Woody Allen does the same thing, and a lot of it, John Huston, the same thing. I've worked with a lot of great directors, but great ones never say a word unless you're doing something that's just not even what they had in mind. That will help tell their story. I mean, John Huston said, acting is 80% casting. Mm-hmm. In other words, you pick the right guy and leave him alone, or pick the right woman and leave her alone. Just let her do her thing because that's why you cast her, that's why you even wanted her or him. And you just let them go. And then because they're doing in the thing, you know, exactly, oh, wow, I never thought of that. The great directors like you to blow their minds or change their minds. They like you to take a chance. Come on, man, you know. I don't need what's been done. I need, you know. And all the good ones, the great ones, they leave you. Or it's like Larry David. He actually got it out of me. I mean, he was amazing. That was one of the most amazing things. Larry David, when I did
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld. I get on stage, you know, we're shooting it, and then he came over to me. He coaches. He's a side coach. He's like Viola. Not in the middle of the shot, but like, you know, in the rehearsal. So he says to Tom, the director, he says, Tom, I want to talk. And he also takes you aside, which is kind of nice. A lot of the great directors do that. They pull you aside. They don't give you in front of everybody. They pull you aside. I always loved that. Oh, I wish the director would pull me aside and give me a little talk. So he pulled me aside. Yeah, Larry David pulled me aside. So I want to talk to you for a second here, Larry. And I go, oh, great. He's going to talk to me. Great. And he goes, I know what you're doing. Very accusingly. I know what you're doing. No, he said, I know what you're trying to do. And that bugged me when he said the word, what am I? So I said to him very defensively, yeah, what am I trying to do? And he said, you're trying to do nothing. And that blew my mind. I go, wow, right, you're right. It just surprised me. I go, wow, you're right. That's exactly what I was trying to do. And what I was trying to do with the Seinfeld thing, you know, Tom Pepper, the guy who stole the raisins, is I was trying to be Buster. I had Buster Keaton in mind. I was trying to totally underplay the writing and the character because it was a very well-written, powerful little piece.
Yeah.
So I go, wow, you're right. That's exactly what I was trying to do. And he said, well, you're doing something. And he walked away. Wow, that's the greatest piece of directing I've ever had. It was. So I go, wow, cool. So he goes, all right. You know, he turns it over to Tom, and Tom says, okay, let's do it again. So I do it again. I got that in mind, blah, blah, blah. So don't do anything to me. So I do the scene, and he goes and cut, and he says, and then I see it out of the corner of my eye, Larry David is sitting towards me, but he's walking like he's going to walk past me, so I didn't even think about it. So he did. He walked past me. And as he walked past me, he just brushed by my ear real quick, and he said, he's going to go. And he just walked by. I said, wow, this guy is so cool, man. So I did even less. And then, you know, the next day, it was cool. Everybody remembers that part. You know, everybody knows me as, hey, did you steal the raisins? And all I was trying to do was nothing, and Larry David got me there. That's a director.
Yeah.
That's what a director. He didn't tell me how to do it. He didn't tell me what to do. He just said, I know what you're doing, and here's how to get there. Less. Don't do it. You know, but it was just succinct. You're doing something. You're still doing it. Cool. Yeah. Cool. So, I don't know. You know, but finally, those kind of things finally got me from the broad stage persona to being here now, real. You know, don't pretend, don't act, don't indicate, just be, you know. And I've talked to a lot of actors, and they all have different ways of getting there, you know. Lee Strasberg or Uta Hagen or Larry David or, you know, whatever, Viola Spolman. However you get there, but, you know, that's all I know, I mean, about acting. I'm not an actor. I'm a comedian who does other things well enough to get by. Yeah.
Well, speaking of those other things, you also have a book coming out. How did you get to the point where you started writing down these stories? How did you decide to start this book?
Well, I've always written. I mean, when I was an actor, you have a lot of downtime, and you either, you know, get something to do or start robbing gas stations. I mean, you got a lot of energy that's just out there.
Yeah.
So I just would write or make films or whatever. Whatever I would get, I started using my acting money as an ATM. If I would get any money, you know, because I was a single guy, if I got any money, I would make a film. You know, I would get a lot of money sometimes just as an idea man. Sometimes somebody would say, hey, I'm writing a screenplay. I just need somebody to bounce ideas off of. And they would give me a lot of money. I would just immediately, I could do a lot of coke or whatever was going on. Or I can make a film, and I always thought, no, man, a film, the high is gone in, you know, a couple of hours, but this film will be around for a while. So I'd always just make a little film with the money. That's what I would do. I forgot the question. The book. So I would write it. So I would just write fables and stories and funny stuff just at night, or, you know, when I had nothing to do, or a couple of days with nothing to do, I would write this stuff. And then finally I put it together for a one-man show, which I started to do randomly whenever I had like a month off. I would rehearse it, take all these writings, and I would tell stories on stage or do these monologues and rants about being a homeless character. I had this homeless character, Emmett. And so I would write Emmett rants, you know, funny little homeless things. Because I lived homeless for a year in San Francisco. I lived in my car for a year. So I got into the homeless thing, and I got that down. I was pretty good at being homeless. I could have stayed homeless. a long time. That's a danger. Okay, that's one of the dangers of being homeless. If you're homeless for a long time, a year, if you're homeless for a year, your brain starts to change.
I bet.
I mean, it's just, hey, man, adapt. It adapts.
Yeah.
And so you get good at it. And if you get good enough, you think, hey, man, this is where I belong. Woo! That's crazy.
Yeah.
I was on the cusp of that, and I just cut out. But so I started writing about it, and that was great. And so I'm very glad. I mean, I don't regret that time. I just incredibly amount of new information. So I was writing all that and doing it on stage, and then finally I couldn't afford, you know, renting a venue or advertising it and, you know, not packing the house, so I was losing money and blah, blah, blah. So I said, oh, I'm going to write it. I'll put it all in the book. So that book is the writings of my fables and stories and oral histories of Emmett and it's political satire. It's satire. It's satire and funny stories. All those writings I just put into a book, and it's called The Loopholes Dossier. And that's one of the stories. It's a political satire. And there's fables and doggerel poems and unrequited love. It's great. It's a great book. And it's coming out. It's out now in e-books. You can order it, and it'll be delivered, I think, on the 11th of October. September 18th or something. You can order it now, and it will be delivered September 18th. And then the hardcover, which is really beautiful. It's got my illustrations. I drew the book. It's my industrial design days. I drew the cartoons and the illustrations.
That's
and they're in color. It's a great book. It's a really good book.
What a wonderful creative project.
Well, but that's what I do. You know, if I get bored, you know, you start thinking, what can I do with my downtime? So I'll make a little film. I don't have money. I'll write a little film. I'll write another chapter for my next book.
So that's what you do,
Robin,
huh? I mean, I talk to people a lot. And one of the things I like to ask people, especially when we get towards the end, which we are, is like what you do when you have a creative lull or a creative block. Do you just keep busy to get through that? Like it doesn't, you know, you don't have lulls or blocks. You just kind of keep doing project after project after project.
Well, because I'm a Sagittarius, I mean, but I don't know, that's just, you know, myth. But I mean, I have a lot of different interests. My brain never shuts down, really. I got a, you know, Dylan, I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. You know, I understand that line. And it's not driving me insane, but because I have very many interests, and I do absorb, something is interesting, I'll just absorb it. And if I'm not interested, then you can't get it in my head. But so when I finish or get tired of writing, like I'm correcting a little screenplay that I wrote. So I'm correcting that. So, you know, after like 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours, whatever, of correcting it and writing it, and I get bored, I go, okay, put it down. And maybe it's 2 in the morning and I'm still not sleepy. So, yeah, I'm tired and I can't write anymore. I can't do this. But I can play my guitar. So I'll write a song. And that all of a sudden, my energy is there for writing, for playing the guitar. So maybe I can't write a song, but I'll learn a new chord or I'll learn a new riff. And so I'll either be tired and go to sleep. Or if I'm still, you know, then, well, I can't play the guitar and I can't write anymore. It's boring, you know. I'm not going to go out for a walk. It's maybe too cold or something. It's raining. So I can paint a picture. Mm-hmm. And so I do some painting. Online, digitally. I paint digitally.
Cool.
So I can do that. You know, in other words, but it's not forced. It's like, what can I do? You know, well, I'll go through that. And it's just, in other words, to me, creativity is just like another thing to do, like going for a walk or riding my bike. It's not like, oh, I'm doing art now and I'm riding a bike now and exercising. To me, it's, well, ride my bike, I'll write a book, I'll look, I'll do that. I'll talk to a friend. I'll go have coffee. It's just, you know, what are you going to do with your time? And I have a lot of options. It's the options, I guess, that a lot of people don't really have options. They just get bored. Yeah. I mean, bored is just time where you don't know what to do with it. It's a thing like anything else. Boredom is a thing. It's unfulfilled. It's like anger. Anger is just unfulfilled energy that's bouncing around inside of you. That's all. If you're doing enough things or if you're really tired, how can you get angry? It's energy that's just untapped. So if something triggers you, bam, all that comes out. So I just let it out by just doing a lot of stuff. You know, some of it's good, some of it's bad. I'm just going through a lot of these little films I did, 1 minute films, 3 minute films. So I'm going through, I got about 100 of them. I just bank them. I mean, over the years, this is not something I did last week. I just, you know, bank them, So I was looking through them the other day. A lot of them are, you know, not worth showing to anybody. And every once in a while, a little gem comes up. So again, it's like the editing process of actors. If I pick out just, you know, one out of 50 is worth showing to a friend. So if I have 300, that's six.
Yeah.
Six gems. Well, if I destroy the other, 204, then nobody knows they ever existed. And I show these six to my friends. They think I'm a genius. You know, they didn't see the 300 that really. What are you, stupid? It's very simple. The editing process of the mind or how you look at what you're doing.
Yeah.
So then, because there's no failure, I just, well, this one didn't work. If I do 100 more, I mean, I'm exaggerating. You understand that.
Yeah.
But the point that I'm making is I just do stuff. That's all.
It's great.
And I just try to do stuff that doesn't get me in trouble because I was a pyromaniac when I was a kid. I got in a lot of trouble. I mean, enough. Enough. Okay, I get it. I mean,
finally,
you got to get it.
I bet you could meet some stunt guys now and do some good pyro stuff. You probably get some good connections world now if you wanted to get back into it. Not that I'm suggesting.
Right. Okay, now wait a minute. What time is it? You know?
What time is it right now?
I have a meeting.
Okay. Well,
I think I got to go.
You got to go. It's good. We are good. You have told me some great stories. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and telling me your great stories. You've been, it's just really great to talk to you and to hear all of the adventures that you've been through. I appreciate you sharing me a moment of your time.
Oh, well, I love talking to you because, you're kind of a kindred soul. You know what I'm talking about. So it's kind of a relief.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.